Chapter 5. Sometimes courage is hoping against hope. Whatever you are looking for can only be found inside of you. Rumi. Alison Caldwell was a young woman who, from the age of 11, struggled with a rare, progressive, and ultimately fatal autoimmune disease called Wegener's granulomatosis. Although she was unable to attend school past sixth grade, her voracious reading and homeschooling by her mother turned Alison into an extremely well-educated young woman. She had a talent for architectural design that amazed professionals who examined her drawings and resulted in an elaborate Lego construction that filled her basement with an entire town designed to her specifications and transformed into reality by her patient mother. Alison was also a world-class knitter who annually won first place awards at the county's largest sheep and wool festival. Alison had the good fortune to come under the care of Dr. Peter Rao, professor of pediatrics at Johns Hopkins. His interest in and support of Alison over the 14 years of her illness is an extraordinary example of compassion and dedication. Finally, Alison's mother, Jean, acquired skills equivalent to those of an intensive care nurse, enabling Alison to remain at home. Her body was confined to her bed by the pain and indignities of her illness, but her imagination and creativity ranged free. Alison's lasting gift in her 25 years of life was to keep a detailed journal of her prolonged struggle to live as well as she could for as long as she could. The task that confronts us all. Following are excerpts from this journal over her last 2 years. January 21st, 2004. I was reading this book about Quakers. I am curious. It is a very low-key individual religion. A lot of it has to do with finding the strength to love within yourself. Everything is very simple. I've read other books about religion. They always talk about how they find guidance in the Bible. I guess I don't understand that. How is that supposed to help me deal with this illness? They talk a lot about love and how God is love. If God is love, why would he, if it is a he, allow sickness to exist? It is hard to reconcile science to religion. Science can at least offer some proofs, evidence. Religion requires only belief. I have always been one to ask questions. I've never felt lost. I just think that I have my own spiritual side. I don't see how praying will help me when I'm freaking out. It just isn't practical. Maybe it helps some people, but I need a real person to talk to, someone to hear my thoughts, my frustrations, someone who can talk back to me. I can call Mom and she helps me. So my religion isn't any group or church. Rather, it is a congregation of me, my soul, all my inner strength, my own determination, my belief that I can deal with whatever comes along. I have a group of people who help me, who I can reach out to when life is too hard. Even in my darkest moments, I have to believe that my inner resolve will always be there, and that my soul is uniquely mine, and the belief in its strength will never let me down. I was born with this soul, and I've relied on my determination to get me through. And that is what I need to embrace. Those things come from within. March 20th, 2004. As time goes on, everything seems to become more and more serious. It got serious with the kidney disease, and then a few months later, the Wegener's, and now the lungs, and I wonder why. It is a useless wonder. April 19th, 2004. We're still reeling from what Dr. Rao said about this illness being progressive and incurable. I think about it a lot. I think about all that I will leave behind. I think about all that I want to do. I think about what I want to do now. I think about what I want people to know. Then I panic, thinking that if I contemplate those things, It will make death real for me. I want Mom and Dad to know what a wonderful life they have given me. In some ways, I'm at peace with my death. In other ways, I'm driven to tears. I need to realize that the strength is in my spirit and soul, to know that my spirit is healthy and strong, even as my body fails. Realizing all this has brought me to a place where I can have moments of peace. September 29th, 2004. My chemo is starting to beep, and then we'll change all the IV stuff. Every day we go through this. No days off. The hardest part is that my life will not get any easier. There are times when I am just so afraid that I can't even explain it. I was looking at my cousin's wedding pictures. I always thought that someday I'd have my own wedding. I realize now all the things that I'll never be able to do. I'm afraid now that things will get worse really fast. November 11th, 2004. I've been thinking about my life and how I really have no regrets, even since the reality of a shorter future became apparent. I think about dying, and it scares me. I can't really talk to myself about it yet. When I think about it, I feel really sad about leaving Mom alone. We're so close, and I don't want to leave her. I am afraid of actually dying. It is easier to just keep going day by day, so I will do that. Something changed when I decided that negative feelings were totally ineffective and negative energy was damaging. I have also come to realize that my spirit, my soul, all my creativity is not sick, and that part of me will never die. Mom told me how much she has learned from me and how much she enjoys our time together. I have learned to live and enjoy every day, all the things we do and share together. I know that I can tell her anything, and I feel so safe when she's around. December 10th, 2004. I want to fight harder and hope beyond hope that this lung disease stops progressing, even as I know that it is unrealistic to expect this. I just can't die. I have too many dreams to achieve, and I can't leave. I have my spirit strength. My soul is strong, and I will eke out every second of this life. January 6, 2005. I do not want to die in a hospital. When I hear about hospice, it is all about dying, and I don't want to be in that category. I feel very sad. Like I've failed myself. I know I have no control over my illness, and my body is failing. I try so hard to live each day to its fullest, and that is really all I can do at this point. February 25th, 2005. I feel fortunate that design and creativity are what I love and am good at. This is something that doesn't take a lot of physical strength. It is a mental process, and I can be in my bed in the dark and think of new knitting designs or Lego building. I've been able to nurture my gifts. I've been able to learn to be confident and not let the world or my illness define me. Mom and Dad have been a big part of helping me see that. My life is far from normal, yet it feels normal. Life is made up of simple moments. There is happiness in that simplicity. Whatever our thoughts and fears, we come back to the moment and try to make each day the best it can be. In this way, I am free to enjoy what I have because I can do what I want to do. It appears that for most people, life is hectic and leaves little time to think, why am I doing this? There are so many things that I wish I could have done in my life. I still hope somehow that I will live a long time and that my dreams will come true. Maybe I'll be one of those medical miracles. I have a strong spirit and sense of self. It isn't easy growing up sick. It is hard to become more and more dependent. I never had the chance to be independent. I do have wonderful memories of my childhood before this illness overtook me. It is those days that I remember, and yet I know I can never go back. I try not to wonder why this has happened to me, since even if I knew, it wouldn't change the now or make it better. All I can do is take what I have, no matter how little, and make it feel big, because simple is grand. One moment can be a lifelong memory. July 18th, 2005. I am still emotionally a disaster. I just can't deal with anything. It is too much, and I feel very angry. Times of peace and joy and calm need to be treasured like gold, because the future holds fewer rather than more such moments. I wonder about the future, but try not to dwell on it. It is enough to just contemplate the here and now. I really want to cry out of complete frustration at times. There just aren't the words to express what I feel. July 21st, 2005. My feet are so swollen, and they don't go down when I elevate them. They look like horrible mutant feet. When I woke up last night, I felt the elephant on my chest. July 23rd, 2005. I was going to write a letter to Mom, just to tell her my feelings and to let her know again how much I appreciate everything she does for me. I have a feeling of frustration and utter chaos, like everything is spiraling out of control. We just get deeper and deeper into the hole with no glimmer of light at the end. Any shining moment needs to be held on to for as long as possible. My focus is very short-term, and usually on what I want to do that day or the next. It is so hard to accept that life will only get harder, that my body will continue to deteriorate while I try to live around it. August 1st, 2005. I can't think of the future. It is too scary. So now is all I have, and I try to make it the best I can. I can't think too much about how awful everything is, because I don't want to waste the present. I have a feeling of unquiet and inner turmoil. I need some reassurance that we'll get through this, and I'll never have to do it alone. I can't knit anymore because I can't see. I have no expectations or goals. The only goal is to make today become tomorrow. August 28th, 2005. I have a lot to write about. I was having a great time a couple of days ago printing tiny flower pictures from the computer for the summer album, when suddenly my back cracked really badly. The worst yet. For some reason, I couldn't hear either. Mom stayed with me until the medicine was delivered. I wish sometimes that I was small and could curl up in her lap and have her rock me. The pain resolved pretty quickly, but the memory is scary, and I've been having dreams of dying. They're so realistic. Life is very difficult and frustrating, and it is all in my face right now. I guess we need to call hospice again. We made raspberry sherbet today, and I got to lick the bowl. Yum! The big news is that Hurricane Katrina, a Category 5, is heading right at New Orleans. I feel so bad about all the beautiful houses that will be destroyed. My writing is awful. I can't write what I feel anyway. I really just want to hide and cry. It is the easiest. Allison died on September 1st, 2005. She left her parents a scrapbook of pictures from her life, along with the following letter. Dear Mom and Dad, from day one, I have been very lucky. I couldn't have picked better people for my parents. From the first times that I can remember, you have been there for me. You have always encouraged me to believe in myself. You have given me the strength to believe I can do anything that I want. Your love has always made me feel very safe. I can be myself all the time and never feel ashamed of who I am. I have that ability because of you. I feel like I can face anything that comes along the road of life. Knowing that you are always there to love and support me has made me who I am today. I have so many wonderful memories of my life and childhood, and they are of the simple times that I treasure most. We have always been a very happy little family, and I wouldn't change any of it for the world. Love always, your daughter, Allison Elizabeth Caldwell. For a complete copy of Allison's journal, as well as pictures of her and some of her creations, go to https://sites.google.com/site/AllisonElizabethCaldwell. Chapter 6. Old Age is the Revenge of the Ugly. Forget safety. Live where you fear to live. Destroy your reputation. Be notorious. Rumi. A derivative of our fear of death is our apprehension about the aging process. No aspect of our identities is more important than our date of birth. We segregate ourselves rigidly by age, and past a certain point in our 20s, share a fear of growing older. Our standards of physical beauty center on the good connective tissue that is the sole property of the young. As we look at the generation ahead of us or the one ahead of them, we are not usually encouraged by models of vigor and optimism. Instead, we have lots of examples, usually including our own parents, of those who complain to the young about the physical consequences of growing older, as if they are surprised at their declining vitality and the diffuse aches that attend this process. Sharing the details of this diminishment is unlikely to entertain or draw us closer to those on whom we increasingly depend. Birthdays come to have a more ominous meaning. Our cultural icons are, in general, those who possess the attributes of youth. And as we grow older, we see fewer flattering reflections of ourselves in popular entertainment. In a vivid demonstration of our priorities, Americans spend roughly equivalent amounts on beauty products and cosmetic surgery as they do on public education. From our earliest years, we are dissatisfied with our age. When we are children, we envy the freedom of adults to manage their own lives. As teenagers, especially, we chafe at the restrictions imposed on us as we seek autonomy in ways constructive and rebellious. Those of us who make the transition to adulthood usually, but not always, in our early 20s. Have you seen the numbers of young people moving back home after college? Are still confronted with the tasks of earning a living and finding someone we imagine we will still love in our 30s and beyond. Somewhere in this phase of our lives, we begin to worry about aging. A common perception of the elderly is that after retirement, they are no longer productive and are reduced to the role of consumers. A patient once described the process of aging this way. It's like climbing a steep hill with failing strength while someone gradually adds rocks to your pack. The rocks are the losses we inevitably accrue as we age. Our youth, our physical attractiveness, our health, those we love. The feeling that time passes more quickly as we age is not an illusion. As we grow older, each increment of time makes up a smaller percentage of our lives. Absent in all this anxiety about aging is any sense that growing older might have its compensations. Freed of the urgent striving that marks our early adulthood, one would think that the elderly would have time to slow down and indulge the pleasures of the mind and body that do not require the reflexes and strength that are gone forever. When I encounter older men who play golf, I am surprised at how often I hear stories of high school or college athletic triumphs. The theme is always the same. I wasn't always like this. Many of them have braces on their knees, damaged on fields distant in time. But the recollection is never bitter, always wistful, as if what they are now, old men trying to play an impossible game, is a rebuke to what they were once and might have been had they not been injured. The subtext of these conversations is that the old have lost most of what we celebrate in this culture. Energy, sexual adventure, a sense of possibilities, and the capacity to change the future. People instinctively prefer freedom of choice to the dead weight of habit and feelings of limited control. One of the major components of happiness is something to look forward to. As the distance between us and our life expectancy narrows, it is hard not to be discouraged, which explains the higher incidence of depression in this age group. In the words of Tennyson, "We are not now that strength that in old days moved earth and heaven." Was the implicit contract that governs our lives never properly explained to us? Perhaps when young, we didn't read the fine print. If you are lucky enough to grow old, you will be stereotyped and marginalized by society, even by your own children. You will become slow of thought and movement and have to cope with unexplained pains. You will experience unspeakable losses that, finally, will include the loss of yourself. This is the bargain. Perhaps if we had absorbed this part of the contract, we could see it through in good humor and without complaint. Such an outcome would certainly be a relief to those who follow us. Instead, we appear more inclined to act amazed and offended by what appears to be a rebuke to our sense of specialness. On his deathbed, the novelist William Saroyan supposedly said, "Everybody has got to die, but I always believed that an exception would be made in my case." Perhaps this unconscious assumption allows us to avoid what could otherwise be a morbid and immobilizing preoccupation with our mortality. Whatever we believe about why we are here, we seem to take the most satisfaction from what we create. For most of us, this pleasure resides in our children and their children, those who carry our genetic material into the future. Few of us are lucky enough to have work that provides real creative satisfaction. Instead, for most jobs, little of what we do lives on after us, and most of what we do can be done as well by others, so our presence is not missed for long. Those of us who have chosen occupations in which we serve others, cocktail waitresses and psychiatrists, for example, hope that our efforts have improved the lives of a few of the people we have encountered. But it is not too modest to believe that the number of human beings who are really better for having encountered us is small. Because I am in a time of life when one contemplates one's impact on the world, I recently tried to estimate the percentage of those thousands of patients I have seen over 45 years of work who are significantly better for having met me. My best guess is around 25%. Another 60 to 70% changed their lives little or not at all as a result of our conversations. I comfort myself that relatively few, therefore, are worse for having met me, but perhaps I am even now giving myself the benefit of the doubt. When I was in training, I told one of my supervisors that I would be interested to find out in 10 years how a patient I had worked with in the hospital was doing. Only now do I understand his response. Don't look back. So, if we elect to take honest inventory of our lives as we near the end, perhaps modesty can coexist with satisfaction. It is given to few of us to leave anything behind that is memorable to others, much less permanent. Perhaps it is enough to have loved those we could, done as little harm as possible, and grown old with enough courage to give hope to, or at least amuse, the small audience who cared enough about us to pay attention. Chapter 7. In Life Beyond High School, No one gives you credit for effort. The difference between what we do and what we are capable of doing would suffice to solve most of the world's problems. Mohandas Gandhi. Fear of humiliation is a modern-day analog of our fear of death. Likewise, a fear of failure often disguises itself as a drive for success. Surveys of business executives have disclosed a high incidence of the imposter phenomenon, an apprehension among successful people that they are in danger of being unmasked as knowing less than they should. As we accumulate more education in any subject, we become aware of how little we know compared to how much information is available. Who among us can be said to have mastered physics or the science of human behavior? Why are people who are experts, if they are honest, loath to make generalizations or predictions? Are they just being honest? Or do they realize more than the rest of us that the unknown, in every area of study, has always outweighed the fraction that we know? An exception to the rule of professional modesty can be seen in those whose job it is to argue with each other and indoctrinate the rest of us in the areas of politics, philosophy, and religion. Here we find plenty of so-called experts prepared to display certainty in the absence of evidence-based knowledge. Fortunately for them, but unfortunately for everybody else, they are seldom held to account for their routinely inaccurate predictions. Most of us are in agreement about the importance of education in the functioning of a civilized society. This idea is based on a belief that an informed population, armed with what is known about the world, will be in a better position to make rational decisions about what policies to pursue and whom to elect to pursue them. How far short of this ideal we currently are can be seen in the level of public discourse about such things as evolution, global warming, and whether a fertilized egg has achieved legal personhood. Where have we gone wrong when we elect people to public office who believe that the world is less than 10,000 years old and that human beings coexisted with the dinosaurs? It is but a short step from there to a conviction that the moon landing was faked and that the Twin Towers were demolished by the government. People impervious to knowledge have always been in our midst. But recently they have been granted access to public megaphones and legions of followers. Clearly our system of education has failed us in some critical areas. School, in addition to transmitting information that we have agreed ought to be taught to young people, provides the laboratory in which we define ourselves socially. We derive our initial sense of where we fit in our complicated society from the way our contemporaries react to us. Only a few of us are comfortably cool. Those who do not qualify must adopt alternative identities to sustain the hope that they will be able, as adults, to get their share of affection and worldly goods. In general, we are not taught the requirements for being happy and the traits to cultivate in ourselves and seek in others to satisfy our need for acceptance and closeness. This educational deficit is understandable because most adults haven't figured out workable answers to these important questions. In the absence of reliable instruction or good role models, most adolescents fall back on peers to teach them how to succeed, especially in becoming attractive to the opposite sex. Most of the learning around these issues is through trial and error. And these frequently embarrassing experiences account for our lifetime fears that they will be repeated. Although the adult world encourages working hard for long-term goals and conformity to rules, adolescents prefer short-term pleasures and individuality. It is paradoxical that at a time of life when we think we will live forever, we often behave as if this were our last day on earth. Then we enter that extended phase of adolescence called college. The news here is that testing of thousands of college students demonstrated not only that on average they spend about 12 to 13 hours a week studying, but that 36% showed no gain in knowledge or critical thinking skills over the 4 years. So what are college students doing with that time? If you said partying, your critical thinking is intact. This reality speaks to more than confirming the old truth that youth is wasted on the young. Such an emphasis on socializing also suggests that well into their 20s, young people are, in general, learning what it means to be successful in a superficial and hedonistic environment. Eventually, most of us have to grow up, get jobs, marry, and start making our way in a world that, in general, values results over display. Although our fears about social inadequacy follow us into adulthood, we now have additional apprehension about making enough money to live comfortably and to attract a suitable marriage partner. Even in a liberated world, most women still hesitate when they hear that their date lives in his parents' basement. This period of striving that marks the early and middle adulthood of most young people is when we become sorted out in the socioeconomic sense. Our educations are complete, and our financial futures are, for the most part, predictable. Although we pay a lot of attention to outliers who strike it rich with novel ideas or financial acumen, make radical career changes, or implode because of addictions or character problems, most of us, though we may change jobs, end up in the same line of work in our 50s that we started in our 20s. Whether this is good or bad news depends on how much you like your job. Most people don't derive a lot of psychological income from their work and see it primarily as a routine activity that feeds their families and allows them to pursue more enjoyable activities in their free time. In our personal lives, meanwhile, a lot of us are engaged in paying for our mistakes, mostly errors we recognize in our middle age that we made when we were young. Prominent among these mistakes is frequently your choice of life partner, which for at least half of us takes the form of divorce from a person with whom we have children. This unhappy fact is the source of a new set of fears about the consequences of divorce and the prospects for companionship in the future. Divorced or not, life in middle age is usually extremely complicated, with simultaneous responsibilities to our kids and to our aging parents. Finally, after we survive all that, we are eligible to start coping with our own old age. If we retire from work, we frequently face a loss of identity, no matter how onerous our jobs seemed at the time we were doing them. We can no longer avoid the reality that the time we have left is limited and must face the gap between our youthful aspirations and our actual lives. No matter our success or lack of it, and who can make that judgment, most of us feel some regret and uncertainty about whether we have played the hands we were dealt with enough skill and effort. Did we choose the right work? Could we have been better at it? Did we spend enough time with our children who now need us hardly at all? We all have difficulty envisioning a world in which we do not partake, even as we receive regular evidence of our replaceability. We cherish a sense of specialness, while time, with its milestones, reminds us of our mortality. We fear extinction and wonder at the meaning of it all. All the striving, all the relationships, all the pain. What difference has it made? What difference have we made? Religion may answer some of these questions for some people, but it poses another. Have we met our obligations to our faith? Chapter 8. Fear lurks behind perfectionism. We are more often frightened than hurt, and we suffer more from imagination than from reality. Seneca the Elder. Of all the burdens we inflict on ourselves and those around us, perfectionism is among the weightiest. Each of us has experienced the products and services of those with an indifference to quality. Toys that break on first use, unreliable and expensive car repairs, incorrect orders at restaurants, planes that don't run on time. hours on the phone waiting for tech support, bungled police investigations. The list of human failures of competence is long. To combat these inefficiencies, businesses adopt all manner of quality control approaches to construct a society in which things work most of the time. Zero defects is an ideal frequently sought, but seldom achieved. Although this process of intolerance for error makes for a reasonably efficient business environment, it has some critical disadvantages when applied to the murky area of human relationships. For example, a Yale law professor, in her book Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, promotes the idea that raising successful kids requires that parents make all the decisions about how their children spend their time, basically either studying or practicing music. Because the secret to academic or musical success is tenacious practice, 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 sleepovers, playdates, school plays, TV, and computer games are not permitted. Nor is the child allowed to get any grade below A. The justification for this regime is that children on their own never want to work, which is why it is crucial to override their preferences. If the child resists this program of rote repetition, it is okay to excoriate, punish, and shame the child. The author tells one anecdote about the horrified reaction of Western parents at a dinner party when she apparently bragged about calling her daughter garbage. Even allowing for some exaggeration on the part of an author selling a book, this material is challenging for parents wanting the best for their kids. We are forced to reflect on issues such as what constitutes success in this society and what values we want to transmit to our children. The debate takes place against a background of concern about narcissism and a sense of entitlement that, fairly or unfairly, are seen as implicit cultural values in 21st century America. The book in question defines success solely in terms of individual achievement, with little attempt to conceal the mother's contempt for the poorly parented losers with whom her children are competing. One would be hard-pressed to find a better example of fear as a motivator than the parenting style advocated by someone who argues that lectures, insults, and intimidation are the essence of successful parenting. Such an approach manifests a deeply pessimistic view of human nature that supposes that our children and, by extension, the rest of us, are fundamentally lazy and driven by uncontrolled desires for pleasure. Therefore, we must be forced by some external source, parents, religion, government, to conform to a set of rules that will make us better, or at least more tractable, people. Such an assumption requires many constraints and prohibitions, thou shalt not, with fear as the basic enforcement mechanism. One need only observe life in a theocratic society such as Iran or Afghanistan under the Taliban to get a taste of how that idea works. Because everyone concedes that we must have rules to regulate our lives together, we must also have penalties for breaking these rules. This is the theory upon which our justice system rests. But our efforts should lie in striking a balance between positive and negative consequences. If you believe that most people have a conscience and a sense of obligation to each other, you are likely to behave and expect others to behave in a different way than if you believe that we are motivated primarily by our own self-interest and are restrained from taking advantage of others only by a system of punitive law. Perhaps 1% of the population, however, are unrestrained by conscience and spend their lives exploiting their fellow citizens. These people are the sociopaths against whom we must protect ourselves. Their incidence in prison populations is about 25%. They respond only to negative consequences and are therefore dangerous to the people around them. Unfortunately, their relentless pursuit of their own self-interest combined with their glib and exploitative personalities sometimes cause them to rise to the top in political and business pursuits. Their incidence among successful executives and politicians has been estimated at 4%. Most of our fears about sociopathic behavior focus on our personal apprehensions. People routinely overestimate the prevalence of crime and have exaggerated fears of being victimized. Entire cable channels are devoted to crime stories. Our fear of violence drives the debate about the need for every citizen to bear arms, even in churches and on college campuses, even though our chances of needing to defend ourselves are vanishingly small. The signal defect in self-absorbed personality disorders, such as narcissism and sociopathy, is an absence of empathy. Most people's concerns about criminal behavior are directed at individual acts of violence. What we should really wish to discern are instances in which those in power, who have the ability to affect the lives of millions, routinely display deficits in their ability to hear heartbeats other than their own. We are entertained by the hypocrisies of politicians, movie stars, and persons of wealth, especially when their offenses involve sexual infidelity. Why is it that the offenders, when exposed, so frequently turn out to be those who have been judgmental about the transgressions or sexual lives of others? Does a connection exist between a public promulgation of family values and a private decision to live differently? Of all the ways we betray ourselves and the people around us, infidelity is one of the most common and consequential. And much of it is driven by fear. Fear of the aging process with its implacable loss of physical attractiveness. Fear that we have not in our lives had our share of novel sex. Fear that others may be enjoying themselves more than we are. The Hollywood portrayal of relationships is bound to leave many with a feeling that they have lived inhibited lives with few opportunities to satisfy their sexual desires. Sex sells, so we are bombarded with images of youth and beauty that seem tantalizingly out of reach for most of us. We are not really taught by our parents or the culture that really good sex occurs in the context of a relationship in which the participants care about themselves and each other equally. Instead, we are frightened with prohibitions, religious and otherwise, that only make the forbidden fruit of extramarital relationships seem more exciting. As Adam and Eve could not resist partaking of the knowledge of good and evil, so we find ways to ruin our lives on the altar of infidelity. Some even argue that people, like most animals, are not wired for monogamy. Television shows celebrate polygamy, though it exists as a gender-specific institution of one man and multiple wives, which raises questions about the role of male entitlement. And we are faced with the question behind all moral judgments: who, if anyone, is being hurt? If the wives, as they claim, are happy with the bargain and have been able to forswear jealousy, what is the harm in any alternative definition of what constitutes a relationship? Perhaps such arrangements are simply another symptom, such as the high divorce rate, of the decline of conventional marriage. And yet most of us cling to the ideal of monogamous commitments, even though half of our first lunges at matrimony do not endure. The ideal of one other person loving us as we are, coming home to us every night, being willing to have children with us, and consenting to grow old together, appears to have a permanent hold on our dreams. So we seek such a person from the time we are young, without knowing precisely who we are looking for. That the process is prone to mistakes, heartbreak, and second effort is daunting, yet inevitable. We know we are born alone and will die alone. But aloneness between these events is intolerable. And so we continue to seek each other out in what I like to call the search for the perfect stranger. A few are lucky enough to find that person. The rest stop at nothing in the effort. If only we had a better idea of who we are looking for, we might have a better chance of preparing ourselves to find him or her and answer the question that drives us. Can two imperfect people form a perfect relationship that will inspire them to forsake all others, not as an obligation, but as a gift. Chapter 9. Courage is not a feeling. It is a habit. To sin by silence when they should protest makes cowards of us all. Abraham Lincoln. Fear is a disorienting emotion. It can freeze us or impel us toward frantic, irrational action. When we are afraid, thinking clearly about cause and effect is difficult. The fight-or-flight reaction is a product of a surge of adrenaline that prevents thoughtful reflection. If fear becomes chronic, we call it anxiety, an emotional disability that is less acute than fear itself, except during a panic attack. We exist in a more or less constant state of worry and unease, and will do anything to avoid situations that trigger or enhance the anxiety. Such avoidance behavior leads paradoxically to the cardinal rule of anxiety. Attempts to evade our fears make them worse. The converse is also true. The only way to overcome fear is to confront it. This response requires determination because the process of fear reduction is slow. For example, many years ago, I had a fear of heights that I seldom had occasion to challenge. But when I chose life as a soldier, the Army required that I learn how to jump out of airplanes. With the help of my fellow soldiers, most of whom were also afraid of this unnatural pursuit, I managed to throw myself from an airplane and was gratified to find that, 1, the parachute opened as planned, 2, the landing I had practiced did not result in injury, and 3, the view on the way down was spectacular. The second time I jumped, I was still afraid, but slightly less so. By the 10th jump, I was enjoying the experience, and by the 20th, I was seeking out opportunities to jump, and had started teaching others how to do it. It's not that complicated. This process, called desensitization, is a model for coping with all sorts of phobias, from a fear of escalators, to crowds, to traveling through tunnels. Facing fear as a way to diminish it is not a novel idea, although it appears to be to those who have never tried it. Avoidance, after all, requires much less effort and does provide short-term anxiety relief. A larger lesson is implied in the decision to confront our fears. What does it mean to live a small life as opposed to an expansive one? That is, a life that benefits others. Our society emphasizes material success. We imagine that the primary constraint upon our choices is a lack of money. That if we had lots of it, we could live large with big houses, expensive cars, and exotic travel. All the trappings that separate the rich from the rest of us. We seldom measure our accomplishments by our influence on others. Most of us have a sense of how important we are to those who love us. Our parents, our spouses, our children. The trust they repose in us is an obligation that we take seriously. When we think of the larger world, few of us believe that what we do or fail to do has much impact on other people. We stop at red lights to avoid collisions, but few of us give anything to the homeless person who approaches our car while we're waiting for the light to change. Some of us even tell him to get a job. He is not part of our world, and we feel no responsibility for him. We argue with each other about what we should do collectively to help those who, for whatever reason, have not succeeded in their efforts to pay their own way. Do the elderly deserve to have income support from the rest of us? Is housing for the indigent a social obligation? What of health care for children whose parents cannot afford it? The answers to these questions are a larger variation of the individual decisions we make about whether to be involved with the lives of others, not simply because there is an unfilled need, but because to be so involved is a measure of the size and value of our own lives. Fear plays a role in these policy decisions, because at some level we know that except for certain accidental factors, The kind of family we were born into, our ability to learn, the education our parents could afford, the demand for the services we provide, the stability of the company we work for. We, too, could be homeless or otherwise in need. One response to such a realization is to confuse our good fortune with some virtue we possess, such as our capacity for hard work. If we can believe that this quality is what accounts for our success, we can blame those less fortunate for their own failure, hence the judgment that they have brought misfortune on themselves through laziness or substance abuse and are not deserving of our help, either individually or through our government. This habit of averting our eyes from hardship works only until we experience our own losses and calamities. When the tornado strikes our street, when someone close to us dies, when we are reminded of the fragility of all we have and all we love, we are finally humbled. We realize, as if for the first time, that we live in a universe where rewards and punishment are, in fact, not allocated by merit. Nothing is odder than survivors of a plane crash who attribute their luck to their faith. "I prayed and God saved me," as if the unanswered prayers of the dead somehow never reached God's ears. In a movie portrayal of a therapy group for bereaved parents, one of the mothers seeks comfort in a familiar formulation. "God needed another angel, so he took our daughter." Another mother asks, "If he needed an angel, why didn't he just make one? He's God, after all." Such mysteries puzzle and terrify us. What is required to respond bravely to the evident fact that we have so little control over what happens to us? First, we must work our way through the pointless questions before we can develop even tentative answers to the ones that lead somewhere. "Why me?" is a familiar response to unanticipated catastrophe. The answer, heartless in its simplicity, is, "Why not you?" A more productive question is, "What do I do now?" The truth is that as long as we live, we are never out of choices. If we can convince ourselves of this truth, we can work our way through the natural self-pity we all experience when beset by life's plentiful injustices. We need to find a realistic place between the narcissistic illusion that we will be spared the experience of watching our best hopes collapse and the belief that life is meaningless if we cannot control it. If we can find such a middle ground, we will not relinquish the fight. Chapter 10. Beware of ideas on which we all agree. We promise according to our hopes, we fulfill according to our fears. La Rochefoucauld. No shared feelings are more firmly embedded in American culture than the admiration and gratitude that we feel toward the young men and women who have served in our most recent wars. Their sacrifices are celebrated at every opportunity, and stories about our wounded warriors and their families are a staple of the nightly news. Our great national spectacles, sporting events, holidays, become occasions for patriotic celebration and remembrance. Rife with clichés such as "freedom isn't free," designed to reassure us that while we personally have not chosen to sacrifice anything during wartime, we at least appreciate those who have made the choice to do so. They stand in their camouflage uniforms, often looking a little mystified at the applause. The reflexive impulse to treat our troops as heroes serves an important purpose apart from relieving our guilt at having done nothing ourselves. The war in Iraq, no less than other wars, involved the morally ambiguous process of killing large numbers of people who posed no threat to us. Because the instruments of destruction were our sons and daughters, we find it hard to take responsibility for asking this of them without regret and self-examination. Ignoring our misjudgments and redoubling our admiration for the young people who risked everything on our behalf are far easier. When the public repudiated the war of my generation, the veterans of Vietnam found themselves criticized or overlooked as unwelcome reminders of a colossal and expensive national blunder. Ironically, we did not learn from this experience that going to war when we are not threatened is an error. All we understood from Vietnam was that blaming our soldiers for the mistakes of our leaders was unjust. And so the pendulum has now swung toward lionizing everyone in uniform, thanking them for their service when they stride through airports like the Roman legionnaires of old, representatives of the American empire that has come to imagine that it can impose its will on the world by the strength of its armed forces rather than the force of its ideas. The Support Our Troops bumper magnets that blossomed as the invasion of Iraq commenced could have just as well have read, "My country, right or wrong." We had been attacked, and now we were attacking back. Afghanistan, which is where the terrorists who struck us lived, became secondary to what our national leadership declared a target-rich environment for our tanks and cruise missiles. Iraq. 8 years, $1 trillion, and 4,500 American lives later, we have finally left. Are we safer now? More free? No. But we appreciate all that those 1 million Americans who served there have done. As long as we honor them, no one need reflect or apologize or be held accountable. Apart from the decisions that led to the war itself, there were, as there are in all wars, things to apologize for. The pictures of the mistreatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib appeared to have only a passing impact on the conscience of most Americans. The muted response was reminiscent of our reaction in 1970 to the images of the My Lai massacre in the pages of Life magazine. When U.S. Marines killed 24 unarmed civilians in the town of Haditha in 2005, or American contractors killed 17 in a busy square in Baghdad in 2007, little note was taken or responsibility required. Most estimates put the overall Iraqi civilian death toll at more than 100,000. Make what you will of the fact that we keep an accurate count of only our own deaths. An Iraqi family is killed at a U.S. checkpoint as they are rushing a child to a hospital. These things happen in the fog of war. The soldiers involved, fearing suicide bombers, had to protect themselves when the car didn't stop. Listen to the words of a State Department official working on reconstruction in Iraq. We tried to convince them we were the good guys and that we'd gotten rid of Saddam. But given all the killings that had happened, that never hung together. He recalled an occasion when he distributed fruit trees to farmers in a rural area. One refused to accept the seedling and spat on the ground. His son had been killed accidentally by U.S. forces, the farmer said. And you're giving me a fruit tree. And so we venerate those who put themselves in fear-inducing situations on our behalf and did whatever they could to survive. Most of them are neither heroes nor killers. Just patriotic people, volunteering to hazard themselves for reasons that to them seemed good at the time. Can we deal with our fears in some way that does not involve the use of bullets or high explosives? Can we celebrate those willing to take risks while creating alternative ways for young people to serve their country that are less costly to them and to others in distant places who love their children in the same way that we love ours? We were sitting down to Christmas Eve dinner at the 7th Surgical Hospital, Black Horse Base Camp, Republic of Vietnam. The year was 1968. It was a quiet night in the war, and the doctors and nurses were looking forward to an evening eating turkey, exchanging presents, and longing to be elsewhere. The bad news came, as it always did, from the night radio operator, whispering in the ear of the hospital commander. "Ladies and gentlemen," the colonel said, "we have casualties coming in." We had heard these words before. The lights were turned on at the helicopter landing pad in anticipation of the medevac Hueys with their cargoes of wounded soldiers. It was always hard to see those young men, bodies shattered, wearing the stunned looks of the suddenly old. But most of us had become used to it, and we waited for wounded soldiers. Not this time. Tonight the harvest of the war was children. They came to us, two or three to a litter, in field ambulances, from the nearby town of Shanlac. They had been in a holiday crowd, and an adult had decided to set off a colorful smoke grenade of the sort the army used to mark helicopter landing zones. They were harmless and gave off red, green, or white smoke. The children must have gathered closely to watch. A pity that the man could not read the lettering on the canister. White phosphorus. The grunts called it White Peter and used it to mark positions for airstrikes. First it exploded into a fine powder that stuck to everything it touched. Then it burned. These children were burning. Except for the very young, they, like the wounded men we were used to seeing, did not cry out. We shouted for cupric chloride to soak the wounds. Water was useless against the phosphorus. Gallons of the blue liquid were hurriedly splashed on the small bodies. Two of the children had been blinded. Several, we could tell, were burned too extensively to survive. As I worked through that night, I thought of my own children far away. The parents of these kids were not allowed on the base for security reasons, so for now, the children were ours. We couldn't get a helicopter to evacuate the most badly burned because no American had been injured. It was an accident, we told ourselves. No fault of ours or our soldiers. But like most of the misery inflicted on the Vietnamese, intentional and incidental, that grenade was made in the USA. By dawn, five of the children were dead. The rest will bear the scars of that Christmas Eve for the rest of their lives. As will I. Chapter 11. There is no humor in heaven. The secret source of humor itself is not joy, but sorrow. Mark Twain. Example. If you don't go to your friends' funerals, you can't expect them to come to yours. Freud conceived the existence of psychological defense mechanisms, unconscious strategies we use to cope with reality and to maintain our self-image. Some of these efforts are pathological, such as denial or delusions. Others are mature, such as altruism, anticipation, and humor. Though it must be said that a lot of what passes for funny is pretty immature. The ability to laugh, especially at ourselves, has been shown to have beneficial effects on both physical and mental health. Years ago, Norman Cousins wrote a book about curing a mysterious and persistent illness by watching Marx Brothers movies. I must admit, however, that I must endorse the following sentiment from a Get Well card. Anyone who thinks that laughter is the best medicine has apparently never had morphine. A popular bumper sticker on cars years ago read, "Hugs are better than drugs." I have been known to put post-it notes on such vehicles in parking lots with the question, "Have you tried both?" People in extremely fear-inducing situations, combat, for example, frequently use humor as a defense. In Vietnam, the people who regularly took the greatest risks were the long-range reconnaissance patrols, LRPs, who were often left in small numbers for days at a time to perform such tasks as count and harass enemy troops and vehicles coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Their compound at Bien Hoa was marked by the following sign, 12th LRRP. Below was a reminder to the rest of us, "No war stories, please." Everything can be a source of humor. Moses comes down from the mountain and says to his followers, "There's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that I got him down to 10. The bad news is that adultery stays in." In 1982, Air Florida Flight 90 crashed into the Potomac River on takeoff, leaving only 5 survivors. The next day, a Washington disc jockey called the Air Florida ticket office from his program to ask the fare from National Airport to the 14th Street Bridge. Even 9/11, which was widely predicted to put an end to humor and irony, produced this. A fireman goes home on 9/11 and tells his wife about his day. "My buddies Stan and I were running toward one tower after the other one fell. But then Stan got hit by a jumper, so I stopped to help him. 30 seconds later, the North Tower collapsed. If Stan didn't get hit, we both would have been goners." The fireman's wife turns to him and says, "Is this going to be a long story?" Or, "Have you heard that American Airlines now has flights from Boston directly to your office in New York?" See what I mean? If we're willing to tolerate some tastelessness, there's little that cannot be lampooned. Our greatest insecurities are fair game. A man and his wife were in marriage counseling. He says, "One thing that bothers me is that you never tell me when you have an orgasm." She replies, "You're usually not there." What are we doing when we laugh at the human condition, even at its most tragic, and thereby at ourselves? A woman says to her psychiatrist, "Oh, doctor, please kiss me." He replies, "That would be unethical. I shouldn't even be lying on this couch with you." In our jokes, we are acknowledging the simultaneous absurdity and infinite value of our lives. Or as one writer put it, "Things may be critical, but they need not be serious." The passage of time enables us to find humor in the most terrible events. Everyone needs to stop making Holocaust jokes. Can you not see how hurtful they are? Because the judgment about what is funny is so subjective, any attempt at humor has an implied risk. Humor is often used as a weapon to degrade or humiliate others, so there is a fine line to observe. In general, jokes that play into stereotypes or target the powerless are not funny. Given the differences in our senses of humor and the virtual absence of it in some people, we are all in danger of giving offense, as I have doubtless done already. Yet it is worth seeing laughter as a courageous and curative act, and one of our best defenses against the fate that awaits us all. The essence of humor is surprise. Most of us can only imagine the courage required to stand in front of an audience with the sole purpose of making them laugh. When Woody Allen said, "I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it by not dying," he was speaking to a persistent fantasy shared by many of us, as he was when he described himself as always putting my ex-wife under a pedestal. If we can laugh in the face of our mistakes and our mortality, we can perhaps bring ourselves to tolerate our existential anxiety and enjoy whatever time we have been given. People with mental illness customarily lose their sense of humor. Years ago, I performed a psychiatric evaluation on an accused murderer in prison. Attempting to establish rapport, I asked him, "What shall I call you?" He responded unsmilingly, "Why don't you call me a cab and let's get the hell out of here?" To this day, I am not sure whether he was exhibiting a symptom called concrete thinking or a sarcastic wit. People who are ill or neurotic are prone to the use of acting out or repression as a mechanism to cope with anxiety rather than the more adaptive defense that humor represents. It has been said, "You don't have a sense of humor. It has you." Being able to see serious matters from a humorous perspective is a habit developed over years of practice. One only needs to watch amateurs doing stand-up comedy to see how difficult it is to make others laugh. Your family may think you're funny, but getting a room full of strangers to agree is hard. If it is true that without sorrow there is no humor, comedy will have little place in heaven. Perhaps things will be less boring elsewhere. A beggar walks up to a man on the street and says, "Can I have a dollar for a sandwich?" The man says, "I don't know. Let me see the sandwich."